Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today we'll talk about human stuff, I'm pretty sure. And I'm very, very curious to see where this conversation takes us. Welcome to the podcast, Luis Rønnedal.
Thank you very much, Amit. I'm very excited to be here and looking forward to this conversation.
And I was kind of flipping through my notes from our pre-call, and there was so much there. So I haven't even set an intention or direction for this conversation, but we'll just kind of take it as it kind of emergency comes up. There will be no lack of words, I imagine. And I'm going to push us off in the same direction I always do with the question, who are you, Luis Rønnedal?
Thank you, Amit, for posing that question, because I think it's a really important one and it's one I often reflect on. And now, you know, when we spoke last week and you asked me again, it gave me the opportunity to kind of have another go at thinking about who am I. And what came to me this time was this realization that I'm a human being who just come home, actually. And I mean that in the physical sense, as well as also, I think, more sort of a sense of who I am, that I found myself. So I'm born in Stockholm, born and raised in Stockholm, Sweden, and spent 20 years abroad, living in 7 countries, having had 5 careers. And I've just recently come home. So that's in the physical sense. So I'm back in Stockholm, whatever that means. And I'm also home. So having lived in many different places, had many different careers, I think I've finally, over the past few years, understood what my work is about and what I'm here to do. And it's about making the world a little bit more human. And I do that, so I'm an executive coach, I'm a facilitator and trainer, and I currently work with an organization called Leadership in Sweden, Ledarintelligens, where our work is really sort of focused on humanizing leadership. So that's my vocation. And I'm very excited to talk to you about that today. And in addition, you know, I wear many different hats. I'm a mother of 3 boys. I'm a wife to a wonderful Italian husband. I'm a daughter. I'm a volunteer. I wear many different hats. But at the essence of it is that I'm a human being. Like everyone else.
I love that. That's wonderful. And actually, I'd love to, as you said, you have had 5 different careers and have been kind of, I don't know, I'm projecting on you, but I'm projecting that there would have been an element of searching in those careers and coming home to this inquiry of the being a little bit more human. I'm wondering if you would want to kind of what was the nature of your search? Or like, how did you, where did you start looking and like, what were the pivotal moments or like, where were the cracks where the light came in or whatever? And like, what, yeah. How did you come here?
Yeah. So I think quite early on in my life, I realized that I had a deep interest in human beings, and people was always the focus of, you know, of my work. But as many of us do, I followed in my father's footsteps when I was younger, and both of my parents are bankers. And so I did the traditional thing. I also studied business. First went to work as an accountant, realized that was quite boring, transitioned into management consulting and then investment banking. And I think when I worked in investment banking, which was around sort of 2010, it was the financial crisis. It was in London. And I looked around me and I saw only leadership by fear and greed. And I started to ask myself these questions. There has to be a different way. And there has to be a different way to lead a more human and more sustainable approach to it. Because also myself, I was suffering quite badly. I was on the brink of burnout, and I felt very insecure and very stressed in my job. And I saw people being laid off without, you know, much consideration, and bankers sitting crying in the subway on the way home with a little box with a few belongings completely by themselves. And I just, there was a part of me then that was really activated, right? Often we get activated by our values, and my value around fairness said, this cannot be right. So at the time, I was fortunate enough to meet a wonderful coach in London, who at that point had just started to do leadership development in the less privileged part of our world, so in Kenya. And he was setting up a charity organization there that was doing leadership development from the grassroots. And I just said to him, it's like, can I join you? I just cannot take this anymore. I've had enough. I need to find, you know, because when I was at the bank, I was colluding with that culture. And so I think that was the first time when I really sort of followed my true, you know, my instinct, right? That I've had since I was young of focusing on something different, of starting to sort of cultivate a more human way of working. And so Trevor is his name. And he just said, you know, I'm running a leadership program in Rwanda next week. Why don't you come? Mm-hmm. So I just booked my flights and went out there, and there was no turning back after that. I did a bunch of other things, but it was all sort of around the theme of, you know, of humanizing the workplace, of humanizing leadership. But that was sort of the most pivotal moment. And I think many of us, you know, we have an inkling when we're young, right? Maybe that it's an interest or it's a dream that we have around something that really sort of resonates with us and something that can develop into, you know, a very passionate work for us. But often we ignore these voices. And it took me 15 years to really find the courage. And it was the brink of, you know, it was the pain of almost being burnt out that made me, you know, look inside. My body said, you just cannot keep going like this either. Why did it have to go so far before I finally listened? Well, that's a different question. But that was really sort of the pivotal moment, because when I was in Kenya and I saw all these young people, you know, in the small villages, in the settlements around Nairobi that, you know, came from very sort of poor and vulnerable communities, when they realized that they could show up with more humanity and be leaders of their own lives, and they, you know, could treat each other differently and really focus on the community, amazing things shifted. So that was the moment for me when I was like, oh my goodness, there is a different way.
Let's see how I can ask this question. But so one thing I noticed is that you were able to shift right before maybe you ended up, quote unquote, properly burnt out, like you were able to hear or adhere to what your body was saying. Which is, you know, and the story for a lot of people around me is that they don't. they keep going. And then the other thing that I'm curious about is, like, there's some, like, if you would compare contexts, which is always tricky to do, but I'm wondering sort of in this sort of successful career path, because I mean, investment banker in London and having sort of not lost your job in 2008 crisis, that's like in certain circles, that would be a certain measure of success. You know, that then you were obviously good at what you were doing. And so what it took to jump versus what it would take for a Kenyan youth to start gaining agency, like, is there a comparison or like a reflection to be made around, I don't know, that unsticking yourself, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. I think, because, you know, your first question was, so why do people not stop before it's too late?
Sure.
Right. And how come I did? And I think these conventional measures of success and you know, the kind of the culture, the society, the families that we're born into, they shape us tremendously. And sometimes, you know, we don't see beyond that. We think that that's our worldview, and we don't pick up our agency to actually see that we can shift things, because we're worried about what we might lose in the process. So yes, I lost you know, status in the conventional sense of it. There are certain friends I lost. You know, this potential to make more money, like all of these kind of things. But I gained something else. I gained myself, actually. And I think that's where I can, you know, the comparison I can make to you know, a young person in Kenya, that actually all we're asking them to do, what we asked them to do in our training, was to find out, or, you know, at least start the inquiry as to who they really wanted to be and who they really were.
And what does the baggage look like for someone in Kenya, or like for someone that doesn't have the material? Because in a way, like what's sticking us in the Western world, I think a lot is the material aspects and like how mitigated our lives are by financial or monetary wealth and or like material wealth in one way or another. And I imagine that to be different in a different context. So like, what's the nature of the baggage? And I don't know if this is a relevant line of inquiry, but I'm curious about that. What's holding us back when it's not sort of success or, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so for many young people, and, you know, I'm not speaking about everyone, and I'm aware that I'm generalizing now, and now it's also been a few years since I was out there. But what I saw when I was there is, because of the extreme poverty that many people live in, many of them, you know, they either they're victims of abuse, or they use a lot of substances to numb their pain. And in order for them to actually pick up the pain, to write the pain, the pen, to write their own story, you know, that's what they have to let go of, right? It's often, you know, certain types of behavior, certain use of different substances. There's a lot of sort of drug abuse. There's a lot of alcohol involved. And there's potentially also standing up to their parents who behave in a certain way and say that, you know, I don't agree with that anymore, which in a community where it's all about, where you need each other to survive, which is very different from how we live in the Western world, often, that can be very threatening. So I think these are some of the baggages. Yeah.
As you said that, it was just like, I'm just like, yeah, okay, numbing. Like, I think we know something about that, a lot of us, and sort of the fear of being different, or taking your own path, or really feeling where you're transgressing on your values and boundaries and so forth. And so, yeah, similar. And so, okay, so you're in Kenya at this point, and then where do you, if we continue your chronology a little bit, what happens then?
Yeah, so what happened then? For a long time, I thought I'll stay out there. You know, it's such a raw, wonderful energy in some of these countries that I haven't experienced in the Western world. But then what happened, I was running a leadership workshop on an island in Uganda, and I got malaria, and I was very sick. I was transported to what used to be the old morgue during the genocide in Kigali, which is the capital of Rwanda. And I was there for a couple of weeks. And lying there, I thought, you know, I'm okay. I'm going to survive. You know, I could pay for the right medicine and so forth. But if, you know, if my children were to be in the same situations, I don't think I'd be able to forgive myself. So I started to kind of to think about, you know, is there a way that I can have similar experiences and look for a sense of community, you know, back in Northern Europe, which is where I'm from. Because as you said, right, there's a lot of the, you know, the challenges are, they might look different on the surface, but they are often very similar when we look at the core. So that took me back to Europe. I did an MBA at a business school called INSEAD. And after that, I decided to sort of to take up a leadership role from within a company and influence that way. So I started a company with a couple of friends in Tanzania, but quite quickly that failed. So I realized that my strength lies in influencing systems from the outside as opposed to from the inside. And so then I did my coach training, and now I've been working as a coach for almost 10 years. And my day-to-day work, very much together with Marika Ronti at Leadership Intelligence in Sweden, is really focused on helping individuals, teams, and organizations to cultivate more human workplaces. There's many different ways that, you know, that we do that, but that's where I've been the past 10 years. It's becoming more and more acute and urgent, also this quest for humanity, especially now when I look around the world and see all the, you know, the wars that are going on, the increasing violence, the rise of authoritarian leadership that we see in many different countries today. And, you know, I'm asking myself, like, of course, there's many different reasons why all of these changes are, you know, are happening. But there's economic, religious, political, historical reasons for it. And what I focus on and what I see is the act of dehumanization that's taking place on a day-to-day basis. And that's the culture that we create, because culture is created moment to moment. So what we do in every moment matters. And what we don't do moment to moment also has an impact.
Say something more about, because I think I know what you mean, or partly know what you mean when you talk about dehumanizing cultures, yeah. or sort of, but what does it mean for you?
Yeah. So of course, on a sort of a macro scale, there's the dehumanization of certain races that, you know, that we've seen. For example, you know, the slavery is a huge act of dehumanization if we look historically. But when I think about it, you know, how it shows up day to day, it's really about how am I meeting other human beings? How am I showing up for other human beings day to day? And when I think about it, also from through the lens of many leaders and managers that we see today, is that they focus so much on, you know, on the task and getting the work done, that it's almost like they see their employees not as machines. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's like it's as a body that can get the work done, as opposed to a human being, which is what leadership is all about, right? So it's when, as a manager, when you sit down and you ask your team member, how are you? Do you really listen? Do you really care about their answer? Or are you already thinking about the to-do list and the next thing that needs to get done? You know, if a team member comes to you and clearly is, you know, under stress or has something on his or her mind, do you take the time to sit with him or her, or are you yourself too uncomfortable to actually acknowledge these emotions? So if we deny another human being his or her pain, if we deny another human being a part of the, you know, the faculty that it means to be a human being, then that's an act of dehumanization.
It's interesting to me that you brought in slavery as a, in the intro. I was just also made aware by another podcast guest some time ago about this, the connection between slavery and the commodification of the workforce and sort of Taylorism and like scientific management. And like, there are actually very direct connections between these things. But there's another, so I'm going to play the devil's advocate a little bit, so there's a way of thinking that that the care and the listening, that it doesn't belong in a company context, or like that's the job of something else. Some other context has to do the care and the listening and the seeing the human. That's not what you're there for. So I don't feel like that. I just want to clarify that. There is a certain cultural stream that maybe thinks a little bit like that. Why not? Why is that wrong? Or like, why do you think like you think in relationship to?
So, you know, so if you are someone who's head of a team or leads an organization, you actually have two hats. The hat of the manager, which is about, of course, to manage the work, right? Setting strategies and budgets and making sure that the actual tasks get done, which is very much focused on the doing. But then you can't call yourself a leader. Leadership is all about the relational aspect of the work. And that has two components. So the way that we work at Leadership Intelligence in Sweden is that we have a model which actually tries to balance these two different hats. So first is the hat of the manager, and then the hat of the leader, which is then about emotional intelligence, how you relate to other people in the moment to moment. And in order to be able to do that, you also need to be able to connect with yourself, which is the third component, you know, of this model, which is the self-intelligence or, you know, spiritual intelligence. And what we found is that in order to maximize performance in organizations, which I'm sure that everyone is interested in, you need to focus, of course, on the management aspect, but also on the leadership aspect, about a 50-50 split. So the doing is equally important to the being, and the doing aspect is, you know, is the leadership aspect, is how you relate to others. Because ultimately, there are human beings that show up for work in the morning. There are human beings that walk through the door of the office. And their main concern is, will this manager or leader, does that manager or leader care about my needs or my concerns? And if he or she doesn't, then that will affect me and it will get in the way of my performance.
And that's, I guess, I like the terminology of sort of the second job. And I can't remember if it's like Peter Senge or if it's... It's one of those people that have, but or it might be Keegan even, I don't know. But that when the manager doesn't care about me, then I have to. And so all of a sudden I have a lot more to do at the workplace. And so I can't focus. I can't do the stuff. But let's go with that. Because I think we're past that a little bit on this podcast and in this context. Like I think most people that listen actually agree and would see that. But I got curious about the third part, like the manager, the leader, and then yourself, like the sort of intelligence, the emotional intelligence, and the spiritual intelligence. Would you, is it useful to go talk a bit more about that? Because I like the spiritual component. I think that's a very interesting thing to bring in.
Absolutely. So again, it rests on this principle that how able I am to connect with myself in the moment is going to affect the way I can connect with others. In other words, how I lead. We can call it self-intelligence. We can talk about it as spiritual intelligence. It doesn't have to be, you know, religious, but it's asking those questions of who am I? Like you asked me in the beginning. What is the work that I'm here to do? And why? Why is it important? What are my values? What is it that I stand for? And what's my, you know, sense of purpose? The meaning. As human beings, we are meaning-making machines. Like we make meaning out of everything. So what is it that gives me meaning? And using that as an anchor in my leadership, and how I'm showing up essentially for my team. And if I'm not able to ask myself these questions or sit with these questions myself, it's very difficult to invite teams to have similar conversations, which is incredibly important. And I think it's now almost 10 years since Simon Sinek talked about this, you know, very famous golden circle, like start with the why or whatever, that then has gone viral. But, you know, then you're depriving, if you're not able to have these conversations with yourself and invite your teams to have these conversations around, you know, why do we do the work we do? How can we make this a meaningful workplace? Then you're depriving your team of a very essential faculty of what it means to be a human being. which is having a sense of meaning. So that's where the work starts. So leadership is personal, like it starts with you. Who are you? What is the work you're here to do?
This might be a skip, but let's see where it takes us. Because I have a feeling that a lot of one of the emotions that stand in the way there has to do with fear, potentially. Mm. And I guess, I don't know if fear is a... But let's see. Let's just play with it. and fear, I mean, it seems to be so present in us. And like from your experience, when we don't have these conversations, what is it that we're afraid of?
You mean the leaders or the people themselves when they hold back, you mean? Or from Yeah. And I love that question, right? It's often, in my experience, it is that what if I ask myself those questions and nothing comes up or nothing's there? We are so afraid of the void or the emptiness or, you know, sense of not knowing. That we make our lives very, very busy and very full. So we actually don't have to stop and ask ourselves these questions that obviously won't have an immediate answer to them.
Oh, that's so interesting. I there's this guy that's been floating around in some of the spaces where I spend a lot of time, and he's been focused on existential risk, and he's called Danish Schmachtenberger. And he said in one of his speeches, he said something like, the best thing that we could do right now, like the one thing that I would know would make a positive influence, is for us to just stop doing everything. Like if we just ceased, like, but that's not going to happen. So, and then there was like a long list of other solutions that just came up in relationship. Yeah.
Exactly.
And so, I'm also curious about kind of what happens. So what's the bridge then to start? Like, where does the courage come from? If we're afraid of nothing being there, then how come some people go there anyways? Or like what?
And again, you know, of course, I'm sure it's different for different people. But I encounter a lot of, you know, senior executives in my work where they reach that point where actually they are, you know, from the outside, they're very successful. They're making a lot of money. They're leading big teams. They have big houses and the car and the boat and, you know, all of that, right? And yet they do feel empty. So it's like the worst drama has already happened. They're already sitting in that emptiness and the void. And then, you know, that fear can be replaced by inquiry or curiosity. Because it's almost like, if I keep going this way, I will have... then my life will have essentially been empty. Even though, you know, you mentioned it before, the materialism, you know, like even on from the outside, it looks very full. But also sometimes I meet people who have had, you know, adverse experiences in their lives. So for example, maybe they've lost, a close one or have suffered from burnout, like we spoke about before. And they start to ask themselves these questions of like, there has to be a different way. Mm-hmm. You know, my days are precious. And so, you know, I've lived in the shadow of death. And so I want to make my days worthwhile.
So it's interesting. So I'm hearing you describe like one part is having experienced the pain or like actually been put through the thing already. And maybe you're still here in a way. So you've kind of, you've faced things that you didn't think were faceable. And so now what? and then the other story, I mean, that's, it's interesting that we, was one of those things that I'm thinking a lot about now. That it seems like what's keeping us from actually being, I don't know, contributing usefully to the shifts that are happening, or like coming in contact with. I resist the word crises, but like the events that are unfolding, anyways, in our society. What we need to do sometimes is just to relax and like not fight so hard to not see, because we're kind of, that's where most of our attention is going, to look away and to kind of put plasters on, or like, you know, reorient ourselves so we don't have to face that thing which is already there. And then, as you were saying, like, what if nothing's here? And just because if that's your fear, then that's probably what it is. Like that is what is right now, right? And so, but it's so interesting how we shift and turn, and how these, you know, the amount of energy that we spend to not have to see or something like that, or feel or sense, or yeah, one of those words.
Exactly. I think that's such a beautiful reflection, because the amount of energy that we spend suppressing emotions, exactly as you're trying, right, as you're saying, it's extraordinary. And we, you know, we keep ourselves busy and, like, you know, avoiding to see, because we worried also that we can't be with the pain. So I've done a lot of work on grief, and grief is a very it's a very wild emotion, right? It's quite, you know, you can't domesticate it. And so people are worried. Their belief is like, if I go there, I won't come back. I would be sort of absorbed by the grief, and I'll never come back to myself. And what I always say to people is like, if you don't go there, you won't come back. So the fear is like, I don't think I can hold this emotion. I don't think I can be in relation to it. That's also why, you know, in the workplace, we shy away from having these difficult conversations or just sitting with our team members, you know, who are stressed about something and have a, you know, or you know, have a level of pain, because we have this belief or all these assumptions that we cannot hold it or be in relation to it. But the only, you know, so I also studied a lot of Buddhism, and one of my Buddhist teachers said, the only way out is through. Like we have to be in relation to, we have to go through in order to come out on the other side. So we can.
So, okay. So I'm curious about, so if we say, well, as you were initially, like, when we started down this track, you talked about sort of the dehumanized workplace. And I was asking you about that. And if we would flip the coin then and talk about sort of the human, like what is a human, or what is a, and sometimes I, you know, I'm even thinking in terms of living, maybe, rather than just human. I tend to move towards sort of a more inclusive in a way, but I spend most of my time in human context, so whichever. but what are the things or the components of such a world or such a place? A human
of a
humanized
world.
Place and a not dehumanized place. Like, I don't even know how to ask the question. It's of a human world. Yeah.
So I think, I mean, I'm wondering how to kind of to answer that question, right? Because to be human is a very complex experience. We have a wide range of emotions. We have a conscious, we have an unconscious. We have, you know, we have our shadow sides. You know, you mentioned the baggage before. And the way I'm thinking about it is like a place where I have permission to show up with everything that I am, and where I also explicitly or implicitly give other people permission to show up with everything that they are.
Mm. I'm curious to weave in the word home here.
Okay.
And just because you said that, you've just come home in right at the beginning. And I have this principle that I use when I facilitate groups that I borrowed from a friend of mine. And that's like, we're here to walk each other home. In the space, we're here to walk each other home. And that seems to have something to do with that permission. And the sort of an assumption of benevolence, almost, like that we are, like, I'm going to assume that all the shit that shows up is here to teach us something or something like that. Like, as the shadows, as the stuff bubbles through and it gets ugly, because it will or might, that's here to serve us or something like that. And then, you know, kind of also what you were saying about the only way through, the only way there is through.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, what it makes me think of is like the shit, right? You speak of the shit. And I think we've gotten ourselves in the trap where we started to also just label emotions as positive and negative. And you know, as if sort of the shit is something, what I, you know, associate that with is something sort of bad or smelly or like something that needs to be hidden. As opposed to simply recognizing that, again, it's a part of the human experience. It's like, it's a emotion, it's a experience. And I think that's where sort of the spiritual practice can be helpful, because a lot of the work that, you know, I've done in the place, in that space, and what that we also encourage people to do when they explore sort of the spiritual intelligence part of leadership intelligence is sort of, is this idea of sort of acceptance. And really just noticing what is without labeling good or bad. We are so quick to judge, so quickly to sort our experiences, people, emotions into boxes. Can we just be in relation to what is again?
And yeah, and I mean, acceptance, I would just to and see if you agree, but I try to think about it as, I could think about it as trust as well. Or I could think about it as, if you want to go one step further out in terms of discomfort with this cultural context, then I would talk about faith. But that there is an element those two, I think, for me, stems from acceptance. Another word that's been sort of, that I would love to hear how you think about, but it's also this word intimacy. How does that live in here, around here for you, like in this domain that we're talking about? Where does intimacy live?
I love that you bring that up, and I get really excited because that's exactly what most of the teams I work with, what they struggle with. And that is simply because they feel like when they come to the workplace, they have to leave a part of themselves at the kitchen table. So they're only showing up with a part of themselves, right? And are constantly sort of conscious or unconsciously thinking, can I say this, can I not? And all that censoring gets in the way of intimacy. So the moments when I've experienced true intimacy in my life, it's when I feel very connected to other people, and I feel the most connected to other people when I feel like I can show up just as I am with what I'm feeling in the moment, and that I feel accepted and held in my experience.
And that's the thing, right? To me, it's like the when humans together, which is like what teams are, really perform well. I mean, you are kind of all oriented towards whatever you're trying to do, and if you don't have to do a lot of parallel processing, if you don't have to keep a lot of stuff out, then you're actually having more focus and attention directed to the thing you're doing. And so therefore, I mean, that's at least my experience and hypothesis is that that's why, you know, we should care about this stuff. That it's a kind of, it's not either or, it's both. And like you are getting more efficiency out of it by, you know, not by letting people loose or like allowing more of you to come into the workplace or into the whichever context you're.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And I read a really interesting article in the Harvard Business Review recently, where they sort of they've done tests with teams where the managers themselves were suppressing a lot of the emotions and didn't show them for the teams. So you know they were going through this process of censoring, and actually, the physical reaction that the team members had in those moments was that their stress levels went up. So their nervous systems went into sort of a fight or flight state, which we know then is getting in the way of performance, and you know also of course impacts health and all of that. So it's also now we can see through research and also you know what we're able to do in terms of measuring the physical body and the aspects of you know the nervous system, how that also implicates this, exactly like you're saying. And you know, of course, if I feel like I don't have to hold back, if I feel like I can just share my ideas freely, if I can challenge constructively, then you also have more creativity, more innovation, and that's exactly what you know what most organizations are asking for today.
Yeah,
but then we ourselves get in the way.
Yeah,
of getting what we want. Out of fear, as you said before, right? I think that that's very key.
There's something, it's so interesting how, in a way, I mean, simple this is. And then when you talk to people, I think out of a work context, then they would say, yeah, of course, you know, with my friends, I just like to relax. And like, I wouldn't be friends with someone that, you know, where I can only kind of show up in a certain way and stuff like that. Or at least most of us kind of feel like that. And then in the work context that changes it, of course, like, and you could argue that the culture and has something to do with like what is work about and so forth. But there are so many aspects of this where we're working really hard to maintain something that's quite unnatural and, or like working to maintain a worldview that we don't really resonate with. Or, and then it comes back to this sort of, but what, so we talked about one part, which was sort of facing the emptiness or like moving through. But either in terms of the model that you're working with or just sort of the your overall experience, like what, could you speak a bit to sort of these bridges that seem, that might be like, what are the bridges towards relaxation or like towards
yeah,
well-being or thriving or being human or being more fully human or something like that. What which ones seem to work? Like what seems to be the things that carry people or care for people or hold people in a way that they can let go?
Yeah. And I think that's a wonderful question. I think it's really important. And that's often the question I get from people, right? Again, when they see the model and they realize, okay, well, I'm too much of a manager. I'm not focusing enough on, you know, on my leadership. Is how do I then do that? And the path, I think, is, you know, whatever you want to call it towards, but to me, it's towards more freedom, actually, because of, you know, all the censoring, right, or holding back and all of that. So that's the path that I encourage people to cultivate. It's like, because when I feel freedom or ease in terms of how I am, how I'm showing up, then of course I have a lot more resources that I can focus on the things that we are here to do together. And so, you know, a lot of it starts with it. What I find is that it's difficult, team members find it difficult to kind of to make these changes if their manager or their leader isn't on the boat. So actually, leaders have a huge responsibility in terms of how they're showing up with their teams to be those role models that invite and give permission for the team members to bring more themselves. And where it starts, it's really sort of, you say you're a team leader and you bring your team to a meeting, is that, you know, you start like you and I did today before we started to record the podcast with, you know, a minute of silence maybe. let's just arrive here. People come from, you know, maybe they come from home or they come from other meetings and there's lots going on. And let's just pause, as you said, like, let's just stop just for a minute and check in. How am I? And then ask everyone to share, whether it's an emotion, whether it's a thought, to ground, you know, to ground oneself and the rest of the team in the here and now. And it sounds so basic, but we don't do it. And it can make a huge difference. I know it makes a huge difference. Because what happens is, like, people's, you know, the part of the leadership intelligence model that we haven't touched on yet is sort of the somatic piece, the intelligence of the body. So because of, you know, the very busy workplaces, the very busy society that we live in today, many of us walk around with a nervous system that is chronically in a fight or flight state, and we're not even aware of it anymore. So when you, as a, you know, it's your responsibility as a team leader. So when you bring people into a meeting and you start it, it's the, you know, having a minute of sort of silence or just, you know, taking a few breaths or whatever it might be, it helps for the nervous systems of your team members to shift into a ventral state. We talk about a ventral state, which is the state of safety, where we feel open, you know, where we, of course, have access to a lot more of our cognitive capabilities, a lot more of our curiosity, and we can think together. Because if people come in and they stay in that state of fight or flight, a lot of their cognitive capability is taken away already when you start the meeting. And then, of course, you don't get the most out of your people. So that's where it all starts. You know, regulated nervous systems co-regulating, because that's a mechanism that takes place when we sit together and we are surrounded by other nervous systems that are in a state of safety and calm. From that place, many different stories are available. So it really starts there, in the body.
Yeah, I like that. And then, as you were saying before, I mean, I've had those conversations myself when you're supposed to give someone quote unquote bad feedback, or like you have to have these like yearly whatever, and you have something hard to talk about and you're so like pumped up with like your pulse is already raising before you start having the conversation. And then like, before you know it, this conversation is already like the only conversation you really didn't want to have. And that's exactly what you have, you know, and then there's no way to kind of hide these things. And sometimes we feel things and it is uncomfortable to deal with some of the interpersonal stuff. But then even just acknowledging that and making visible that, okay, I'm really nervous right now. I'm afraid of this, or like I'm nervous about this conversation. Even that might be, it's not the perfect solution. Ideally you would do something else, but it's still better than trying to hide it, as you were saying before with the manager. That
exactly. And that's so that's so important what you're saying now, Amit, because when we, you know, we talk a lot about sort of labeling or naming emotions, that's part of sort of the self-awareness piece. It's like when I name or label an emotion that I'm experiencing, I connect to something. Something clicks for us. There is that body, you know, mind alignment in the moment that also makes the nervous system relax. So simply just naming, this is how I'm feeling, can make the nervous system shift, my own nervous system shift from a state of fight or flight, you know, into safety. And also for the other person, right, who's otherwise, the nervous system of that person is sitting there trying to figure out what is going on with my manager, right? Yes. And that takes all the energy. And it's very difficult to relax if it's difficult for me to read the other person in the moment, or I get a sense, like my body get a sense that this manager is feeling nervous, but like that doesn't match the words that come out of his or her mouth, right? Then there is that disconnect. And then that is definitely, you know, a threat signal to my physique, and off we go. So
I wanted to shift gears and talk about the, because I'm curious about the spiritual component. I think that's one of those things that are, that because a lot of the stuff that we have been talking about now is I think it's present in quite a few models. And it's like, it's not like if you're on top of what's going on in leadership right now, that a lot of this stuff is kind of there. And like, it makes sense. And if you start taking into account how we actually work as biophysical, spiritual, whatever organisms are. But the spiritual component, I'm curious about, because I mean, you've been working with cities and you've been employing this in very sort of whatever mundane contexts. And then you have this component in there that talks about spirituality. And so I'm wondering, how does that go over and what does it do to people? Like, can we, what's the bridge? Like, not when you're talking to normal, quote unquote, people, not like super passionate entrepreneurs that are like living out their wildest dreams to the workplace or whatever, but like people that go to work and do their job and they have a life, quote unquote. Like, where does it live?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think a lot of it is anchored around this idea of purpose, you know? Who am I and what am I here to do? How will I know at the end of my life that I've lived a life worthwhile? What does that look like? How does that then translate to how I show up, how I act on a day-to-day basis, essentially?
And yeah, and I mean, some stuff that we've encountered in when we've been doing leadership work, and especially when you're like coaching and coaching becomes personal usually quite fast, and then sometimes you run into this dichotomy by like where the person maybe it becomes obvious to everybody involved, like both the coach and the person, that like I shouldn't be here anymore, like this context is not healthy for me, or like I'm not living my that's kind of, I guess that's indirectly what my question was about, like when you might put like the spiritual seems like a potential, like a very rich source of, because it's not about fixing, you know, there's also a question of like, should I leave, or like, do I need to go get away from here? And then how do you deal with that if that's the outcome, or like if there isn't fit between what your spiritual purpose is and where you're currently working is?
So I think there's different parts, you know, to this idea of purpose. And one of the questions that I think is essential is, how do I want to serve the world, right? What am I about? But then it's also about a sense of community, where I'd like to do this work. And then essentially is the third component is, what is it that I love, that sets my heart on fire. So sometimes when people come to these realizations around sort of what is my purpose, or what is it that, you know, that makes me thrive, maybe they have an immediate inclination to kind of, oh gosh, I need to resign and that's scary and I don't know what to do. But often we can find maybe one or two of these aspects within, you know, your current, in one of the systems that you currently operate within. And so there's ways often to create a larger sense of purpose where you are. But then sometimes that's just not the case at all. Like when I left, you know, when I was in banking, I just couldn't see it. And then we have to make these bigger changes if we want to be true to ourselves. And that can be scary. But yet, it's very rare that I hear someone who has made these changes say, I regret it.
A reflection from my side now is sort of that it might have to do with capacity as well. Because I tend to believe that, but that's where my faith and trust comes in, that I am in the context that I need to be to learn. But then some of the context might be above what I have capacity for dealing with at the moment. So like, it's not that it is not possible for me to be true in like, I can be true in every context, but it might take more of me than I have to offer at the moment. And then of course there's like, maybe I can stay and learn to navigate it, or maybe I need to leave to learn to navigate it, but bring with me the learning of what it was to be in that context.
Yeah, but there, you know, there's, you know, we human beings, we live in relation to systems, right? And so, of course, the system around us has a huge impact to what extent we feel like we can live out our purpose. And it's difficult sometimes in existing, you know, systems to start to show up very differently, because those other people, they like to keep us in the place where we used to be. And so, you know, we have a lot of people who, you know, who support the current version of us, but we need then to surround ourselves with enough supporters of who we are becoming, of our becoming.
In a way, I'm wondering if that's actually a pause point, but then I'm wondering also, like, what is it that we didn't talk about? Like, what is it that I should have asked where we didn't go? And so is there something I should have asked, or like, are there, what else could we have talked about that would have been sort of, or is there something else that wants to be said, given in light of the conversation that we've just had?
I guess there's only, you know, one last reflection, which is sort of, again, on the theme of spirituality, right? That, you know, you asked me how it shows up, you know, for the workplace, but also the way I think about it in a broader sense is that it's about expanding our consciousness, but within three specific realms. So it's this idea of sort of purpose and meaning that we talked about, but it's also this realization that we are interconnected. We are not separate individuals. You know, we are all interconnected, and Dan Siegel has done an amazing piece of work on this. And then the last part is about transcendence of our, you know, of ourselves, and our sense of selves, which is then, you know, peeling off the layers, all these labels, you know, that we talk about that often, you know, keep us hostage and keep us stuck, and peeling it all off and really sort of looking at what is the core, what is the essence of my being, beyond the ego. So, and that doesn't necessarily always come into, you know, to coaching conversations, or, you know, but that's anyway, in terms of how I'm thinking about it, these three realms.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because, you know, when you say that, then in terms of my question of what happens if you need to leave the place where you're at, like that kind of, it kind of takes a bit of the edge of that question, because if you know, if you take the interconnected part seriously, then it's an irrelevant question, because you just need to switch context. And then when it comes to transcendence, then maybe it is more about learning than something else. So there is actually a way of navigating this, but then it also requires a perspective shift. Like, it requires you to have the capability to see it differently, and like, to maybe zoom out a little bit and be less worried about the next project or the next staffing meeting and the next thing, and see the bigger picture.
Exactly.
And that's hard sometimes.
It is hard, but it's doable and it's achieved. And, you know, and I love what Jon Kabat-Zinn said about this. He said, you need to become someone to become no one. I think you need to go through this process of, you know, of like feeling that sense of sort of identity related to your title or, you know, your culture or whatever, to be able then to transcend it.
Mm. That's interesting, yeah.
So it's a process, it really is.
And like, I'm, oh, so let's see. There's something in me around, I've been reading a little bit of Hindu mythology and like Hindu cosmology lately. You have four different paths for achieving your enlightenment, depending on sort of your disposition as a person. And it's not clear cut, like where you would be, but you have the four different types of yoga which would be sort of Raj and Karma, and I can't remember the other ones, but like there are different ways. And so depending a little bit on your skill set or your disposition as a person, you would approach it differently. So I guess if you are a careerist or a recovering careerist or a recovering sort of performer or something like that, then that might be true. But I also wanted to just kind of voice that I think sometimes we are a little bit too categorical with like, this is the path that has to be, or like that there are also people with different capabilities that have, you know, they some of the Buddhist, like the monastic Buddhist practices that are like, they're just doing the inquiry thing. Like they were never anybody to, so to say, but then yet they were able to break through or find. And like, so I don't know. I don't know why I needed to say that right now. I know, you know, but there's something around something. Yeah. I'd had to say that apparently. Yeah.
And I think, you know, so I think that's the way of bringing it together. It's like, you know, you have to find your own path, you know?
Yeah. And it's an invitation to, I guess, comes back to that, like very core skills of being leader is to listen. And it is to maybe meet and in with the intent of setting free, maybe, or like liberating.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's beautiful.
Which is it's an essential human need that we often deprive ourselves and others of, a sense of freedom.
That was a conversation too. if people want to if people want to reach you or work with you or learn more about leadership intelligence, where would you direct them?
Yeah, so they can come to our website, which is www.ledarintelligens.se, or I also have a personal website and that can be found on LinkedIn as well.
Yeah. Those links, all the three of them, will be in the show notes, clickable. So it's very convenient and low friction to be able to find you. Thank you so much for leaning in and for doing this with me. This was fun. And it's nice to circle around these topics, always uncovering more nuance.
Well, thank you so much as well. I really enjoyed it. And I also have learned a lot from you today, Ahmed. So it's been great having this conversation. Thank you.